Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
You know those cute little die-cast models of tractors? If you buy one, be careful, because that's how it starts.
And then from there, it just kind of blossomed into a hobby that's gone wildly out of control.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We're going to start the hour in the world of farm toys. We'll visit a farm toy auction, talk with collectors, and the manager of the National Farm Toy Museum in Dyersville. Later in the hour, a different kind of collectible, old and rare books. Some books are worth millions, others, although they may be ancient, are much less valuable. I'll talk with the creator of a new game that can help students understand the history and value of books. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going to talk about two very different kinds of collectibles. Later in the hour, old and rare books. But first, farm toys. You know those little die-cast tractors that maybe you played with as a kid? Those little tractors and other farm-inspired toys and models have inspired a huge following and collectors from all over the world. Several times through the year, there's a farm toy auction at Yoder Auction Service in Frytown, a very small community in between Iowa City and Kelowna. On Saturday, Iowa Public Radio producer Ben Stanton stopped by to chat with a few people there on the second day of the auction. There were about 100 people there at the time and about 15 8-foot tables covered with farm toys. All of them were John Deere models.
Hi, my name is Al Kuntz and my wife Marilyn Kuntz. We came to this auction because there were a couple of items I was hoping to get. The one went too high. The other one I'm still hoping to get it. The stuff we bought today is mostly to take back home and resell at little trade shows that we go to. And we came a long way. We're from Canada. And the hobby, how I got into it, was it was mostly equipment that I had when I farmed and what my dad had and what my grandfather had, and then you buy that toy to replace that real piece of equipment. And then from there, it just kind of blossomed into a hobby that's gone wildly out of control. Well, I have a lot of Case IH and Case toys, which is red and not green. I don't have a lot of green toys in my collection. I have a lot of Versatile, and that's a company that made big four-wheel drive tractors just in Canada. They sold them all over the U.S., but it's a big tractor company in Canada, and I've got pretty extensive Versatile collection, which is, they're popular down here, too. There's just none at this auction, but, and then I've got banners, and I've got brochures, and I've got just all kinds, belt buckles. Anything that's related to the ag sector collecting, I try and collect. We bought so much stuff here, we had to buy a cargo trailer from the man down the road here to take it home. And we have two trailers at home that are full, plus all the stuff on display in our collection. So, yeah, but it's a lot of fun. You get to meet a lot of neat people.
Yeah. Where do you put all this stuff?
We have a lot of it on display in our house, but the rest is in two big cargo trailers. And like I said, we sell at about four shows a year, and one of them is a really big show in Alberta, which is a four-day-long toy show within a huge farm show, and then we go to some really small shows where they have Thresherman days, and you set up there, and it's fun and an interesting hobby, and most people get started because of what Dad had or what Grandpa had on the farm. That's exactly how everybody gets started in this hobby. And it's only one or two pieces, and then it just snowballs.
So can you tell me what you got stacked up here?
Yeah, I bought a lot of these John Deere four-wheel drive tractors. They sell really well back home, and I had some guys wanting those toys. They said, if you see a couple of them, buy them for me, and of course, you know, I'll sell them to them. And the rest are just toys that I know sell good at shows that I go to. Mostly John Deere. I don't think, yesterday I got some other ones that were you know, Oliver, and there was a couple KSH toys I managed to find, some Alice Chalmer and stuff like that. But today is predominantly green, and a lot of good toys. There's some good ones to come yet. I'm hoping to get one of them, but I don't know if I will or not. Yeah, the one I was thinking about, it went for over $700, and it's a bit rich for me right now. yeah, but it was, you know, one of maybe only about 12 pieces made, that specific item, you know, so there's not a lot of them out there, and that's what makes them so rare.
My name is Howard Geyer, and I do farm toy restoration work. Well, somebody will bring in a tractor maybe they've had as in their youth and want it repaired and restored to look like new again, and that's what I do. If there's any parts broken off or any piece that might need some resoldering, something like that, I'll do repair work on it, repaint it, and redecal it, and give it back to them. I'm from East Moline, Illinois, and I've done this for probably 30 years now. And people will either send them to me because I've worked for them before, or word of mouth, or I attend farm toy shows throughout the country, and they'll bring them in there to be repaired.
So, but you're a collector too?
I do a little book collecting, yeah, mostly international. I worked at the Farmall plant in Rock Island for a few years before they shut down.
So is that when you got into collecting then?
Yeah, I started then.
What do you like about it?
It's just fun. It's something to do. It occupies the time. It beats hanging out in the bars.
Brandon Harland. I'm from Jasper County, near the town of Collins. Started collecting tractors when I was younger, and finally got old enough to where I had a little bit extra money to spend on an actual collection in the box, and have been doing that for about the last 2 years, and collecting those with my son Silas, who's 5. So just collecting tractors, something he can have when his dad's gone.
So how did it get started in the first place?
I just had a lot of tractors growing up. My folks had bought for me and played with, and I still have a lot of those. They're not obviously in the box. They're used and worn, but I still have a lot of those. And the ones I don't have, my nieces and nephews have. So just trying to replace those with similar items that are new in the box still, that others were fortunate enough to keep and have in the box new. So a little bit of significance there from a childhood standpoint, looking back at some of those things I played with and how I probably didn't take the best care of them, but now I can.
So. Well, any favorites in your collection?
Not necessarily. I like the big four-wheel drive tractors and the mechanical front 4000 series tractors, but other than that, nothing real specific. A lot of the things I really like are going for way more than what I want to spend.
That's a little bit of sound from a recent farm toy auction at Yoder Auction Service in Frytown, Iowa. And now we're going to find out more about collecting farm toys. Kate Bossen is the owner of Bossen Implement. It's a store that sells farm toys and models in Lamont, Iowa. Hello, Kate.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
No problem.
And now we're talking about farm toys, but I think we should make a little bit of a distinction between toys and some of the models that people invest in. Can you draw that distinction for us?
Yeah, we kind of refer to everything as toys, but they definitely are not toys on the replicas that, you know, like the precision models that Ertl makes. They're aimed for the collector market. You know, they have great detail on them, a lot of, you know, functioning parts, things that work. And they're not at all designed for kids' toys, and so there's a lot of those that have come about since the early 90s is about when the Precisions came out in 1990. So since then, it's been a lot of you get the models and then you get the toys.
So when people come to you, are they looking for the toys or are they looking for the models?
We get both. We get mothers and grandmothers looking for toys for the kids to play with, you know, for their birthdays or Christmas, and we get the gentlemen coming in looking for the models for their collections.
How did you get involved in farm toy collecting?
Well, believe it or not, I'm not from a farm, and I don't have any farming background at all, but I when I was in college, some of my professors were into the miniature tractor pulling, where they take a model toy tractor, put an airplane engine in it, and hook it up to a sled and pull it like the real tractor pullers. And they were kind of into collecting, and that's where I got the bug, was from them.
So why do you think it appealed to you so much?
I like anything mechanical, always have. I've always liked trucks, cars, planes, trains, and the farm tractors were really something I don't know why I related to them, but I did.
So what, these are models of mechanical things. Can you tell me a little bit more about what really appeals to you about these models?
Well, you know, I've always, my family thinks I'm adopted sometimes because they don't understand my interest in agriculture since I grew up in the city. But I've always had an interest in agriculture, and I think the big tractors fascinated me, and they still fascinate me. And so collecting the miniatures and having those to play with, you know, or put on my shelf is neat. When I was a kid, I actually made dioramas of farms, and I had all the Matchbox toys that were farm-related on my miniature farm. I took over my dad's ping pong table, and I used construction paper, brown for fields and black for roads, and I made houses and used the Quaker oak can to make my silos.
Wow. So this has spoken to you for a long time. And you started Boston Implement back in the mid-80s. Back then, of course, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have the ability to buy things online. So you got a lot of business from all over the world, right?
Yes, I did. I was going to toy shows, and first I started going to shows just to buy models for my collection, and then I started buying, you know, case lots from the case dealer that I worked for, and took those to the shows, and I'd sell the 5 models out of the case, and the 6th one was mine, and it didn't cost me anything because I made money on the others. And so I was able to grow my collection, and then the selling became just as much fun for me as the collecting. So one day when I was coming home from my toy show, driving a long distance, I'm thinking, going, I need a name for my new fledgling business. What do I want to call it? And I thought, you know, I feel just like a real implement dealer. I sell new and used toys, tractors. I sell parts for the tractors, and I do some repair work. So I said, gee, it should be Boston Toy Implement, but I didn't like the sounds of that, so I came up with Boston Implement, your toy equipment dealer.
Nice, nice. So why do you think people from all over the world want to buy models of American tractors?
Well, actually, American tractors have been exported since they began. So there's a lot of vintage tractors all over the world. And so the countries that are, you know, have large agricultural bases, you know, where they've had a lot of farming and have imported the tractors since, you know, the teens and 20s and on, those guys are just as passionate about their hobby as us Americans are. And if they had a John Deere A or B on the farm back then, they want those too.
Well, thank you so much for giving us a little bit of a glimpse into your world today, Kate.
You're welcome.
Kate Boston, the owner of Boston Implement. It's a store that sells farm toys and models in Lamont, Iowa. We're going to continue our conversation in a moment about farm toys. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are talking about collectibles, 2 different kinds of collectibles. In a little while, we're going to talk about old and rare books. But right now, we are focusing on farm toys, those little die-cast tractors and models of farm implements. They have inspired a following around the world. And we heard from some sound from an auction where people were traveling to buy these models. And now with me on the line is Amanda Schwartz. She is the manager of the National Farm Toy Museum in Dyersville. Hello, Amanda.
Good morning, Charity.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And give me an idea. I mean, I was just talking with Kate of Boston Implement, and she gave us a little bit of a glimpse into how big this world is. But to collect all of these toys and models together in a museum, I think that gives us a really nice view of how vast this collection can be. Tell me about the museum. What's in it?
Well, we have two floors of farm toys in our museum. There's well over 9,000 farm toys in our collection, and we also have displays or dioramas that illustrate the history of agriculture through the farm toy story. So that's kind of our contribution to agriculture, is kind of being an sneaking in a little bit of that fun educational component and just letting people know kind of where their food and all this hard work that is in the farming industry comes from. So,
how many toys would you say you have in the museum?
A little over 9,000 in our collection.
Little over 9,000. And are you constantly collecting more?
We are continuously collecting more because they come out with new models every year. So, and we are always, you know, our museum was founded in 1986. So and the hobby obviously started much earlier than that. So we're always playing catch up, trying to get some of those elusive early models as well.
So when I think about farm toys, I immediately do think of those, you know, the little models of tractors. But they're making so many more kinds of models and toys now than they used to be. Can you give me an idea of some of the things that maybe most of us wouldn't expect to see at a farm toy museum, but they're there?
They're there. We collect toys from all over the world. So we have some international, or I should say foreign toys. I get in trouble with that one because there's an international farm toy brand well. So, we have foreign toys in the museum. We have, you know, toys. I have a handmade toy from Zimbabwe that was donated to the museum that was made out of items along garbage items that children made. And so, you know, I mean, it's kind of a fun way to see how these toys, and that's how historically toys started, was replication of what they saw, kids saw. So, yeah.
And with our rural landscape changing, you're also seeing models of things that we might see in rural Iowa today, even wind turbines.
Absolutely, yes. Wind turbines, you're seeing those in dioramas along with drone technology, and all of the modern tractors that you'll see, even mass-produced ones, will have the GPS on the tractors. That technology is a reality. So kids today, when they're driving down the highway and they see the tractor, that model is being made today. So, yeah.
How did you get involved in this?
Well, you know, it's kind of one of those stories of in the right place at the right time, and I was able to secure the position. I actually have some tractor history in my family as well. My grandfather worked as an engineer out of Iowa State for International Harvester, and then actually started at John Deere in Dubuque. So that's kind of where some of my tractor background starts.
And do you have a personal collection?
I do have a small collection, yes. I like some of your folks earlier said, it's always fun, but to collect items, and it's always having the available funds for that. So, and there are some amazing collect pieces out there. So, yes.
And as the manager of the museum, as the curator of this collection, I mean, you're doing a lot of education when people come in. So, what kind of research do you do to learn more about these models and where they come from?
I do lots of great, lots of fun research, and this is kind of where my passion lies a little bit with the museum as well, is just kind of doing some of the background research on these major tractor manufacturing companies and, you know, kind of being able to illustrate the evolution of the company through the farm toy and show how the toy and what was needed for the farmer to continue constantly be innovating and making their hard work just that little bit easier, if at all possible, with the equipment that they're given.
Tell me about a couple of your favorite things in the collection, because you have some really unique things.
We do. You know, I guess for me, obviously this is like picking your favorite child, but but I would definitely, I do love one of the pieces that we have currently on loan is one of the early John Deere A's. It was produced by Ertl in his basement, Ertl Sr., and that's kind of the history of how Dyersville became the farm toy capital of the world, is through that toy, and that was kind of the creation of the Ertl Farm Toy Company, and which is now owned by Tomy, T-O-M-Y, and that is kind of a amazing history to see how somebody innovated and created and came up with a company that is known throughout the world today.
Well, and for people who aren't, I'm sure everybody in Dyersville knows, but for people who aren't familiar with the origin story of Ertl Toys, tell us just briefly how this did get started.
Yeah, so Ertl Sr. was actually worked in a foundry and was laid off, and he actually had an early tractor that he used, and he actually created sand molds in his basement furnace and then went around with those toys. His kids hand-painted those tractors, and they were he went around and sold them, and that became their family business, and eventually they had a business in Dubuque, and eventually they outgrew that location, and the kind of forefathers in Dyersville courted them to come out to Dyersville, and that's kind of where our history here begins in Dyersville, and that's why Dyersville is stamped on a lot of those early toys, Dyersville, Iowa. And I had a visitor from England who came to the museum a few years ago, and he was bound and determined to come and see Dyersville, Iowa, because of this toy that he owned when he was little.
Wow.
So, yeah.
I'm talking to Amanda Schwartz. She's the manager of the National Farm Toy Museum in Dyersville. We're talking about farm toys and farm toy collecting. If that's a part of your life, you're welcome to join our conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Chuck Steffen is going to join the conversation now. He is a collector of farm toys. He's also a custom parts maker and lives in Sherrill, Iowa. Hi, Chuck.
Hello, how are we doing today?
Great. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, how long have you been involved with this?
Well, I've been collecting toys since I was a young kid, you know, and it just keeps evolving slowly and surely, but we've really got serious the last few years here in custom building and parts world. But about, I'd say probably about 3, 4, 5 years ago, I guess I probably went a little bit farther and faster than I was thinking I was ever going, but yeah, we're making quite a few parts now, so.
Wow. Now, how did this get started for you? You mentioned that you played with the toys as a kid, but
Yeah, that's exactly how it started. You know, you started out as a kid, you know, and dad's out running the tractor. What do you want? You want the same thing, and, you know, before you know it, you're getting a little older, and you're starting to collect nicer things, and, you know, you get to the point where I was starting to get quite a few nice tractors in my collection, but you know, I always want to tinker with them. I always want to personalize things.
Why do you think that is?
It is. I mean, I guess that's the way I am. You know, I always want to personalize things. I wanted the tractor just like Dad had or Grandpa had, or, you know, that way. So you want to build it that way. And, well, then I ended up buying tractors, and, well, you never had time for it, Then about 07, 08, when the housing crisis went through, you know, I took some voluntary layoff. Well, I ran out of excuses why I wasn't getting none of this stuff done, and finally went out and I started getting into it a little bit more, and well, here I am today. So
now, how do you make your custom parts for these toys and models?
Well, we use a little bit of 3D printing. We use a little bit of a spin casting, injection molding. We make it ain't just a simple procedure. There's no doubt about that. A lot of times some of the parts are just made by hand, you know, just start out with raw materials, weld them, solder them together, whatever. You know, I've learned how different ways of casting products. So, yeah, I guess that's the best way of describing it.
And do you find yourself repairing models, or is it mostly add-ons to models that are in pretty good shape?
Most everything I do is going to be new in the box stuff that gets customized. Mainly just getting things personalized. I mean, just like it was for me, you know, I wanted things just like my dad, grandpa's tractor was. Well, a lot of my customers are that same exact way. You know, they want the tractor their dad had or they have themselves, you know. So, and Ertl puts out, or Ertl Spec Casting and them companies to put out a nice piece anymore. You know, they just want to personalize it. So I'm there to do that for them.
All right. Give me an idea of exactly what you would do to a tractor to personalize it. I'm imagining, you know, maybe putting your initials on it. That's not what we're talking about here.
No, the sky's the limit to that. I mean, I guess one of the best ways to say, if you know really anything about farm and you go down south, and the farmers down there, they have these tires that are called rice and cane tires. They're a tire that nobody up in the north works with, but down south, that's what they have. All their tires are rice and cane tires down there. Well, I produce them tires, you know, and then they put them on their tires down there. I got customers that weather tractors. What they actually do is they actually age the tractor, make it look old. You know, they'll have the actual door on the tractor busted off or something like that. They have pop cans in them. Well, they don't want to have these new tires. Well, I offer tires that actually show wear on them, road wear on them, you know, to actually age the tractor and make it look a little more, you know, authentic. Well, then we got guys that build pulling tractors, so, you know, you want the correct tire to go on there. So I make pulling tires to go on the tractors for them, you know. So then make a lot of weights. You know, a lot of people, you know, they want to put weights on them, different types of front ends. I cast different front ends.
Why would they want to put weights on them?
Well, just the way their dad's tractor was, you know, or if it's a pulling tractor, for instance, the pulling tractor would have had weights hung on it, so it would have been in the, you know, 9,000-pound class or whatever, and the tractor would have had to make weight, so we make the weights for them to put on their tractor.
So when you sell something that looks weathered or looks worn, are you making it so it looks worn, or do you have to wear it down once you make it?
Well, I don't actually do the weathering of tractors. I got guys that do that. I don't build them. I know some talented guys that do that. I make the weathered parts, the tires. Like, for instance, the tire, like I said, the weathered tire, what it is the road-worn weather tire, just like on your car, after a while your tires wear out. Well, these guys are building these tractors, and they're showing the wear and tear on the tractors. Well, they don't want to have a brand-new set of tires on them. Just like your car, they want to have tires that are worn out. Well, I actually build tires that are brand new, but look like they're worn out,
nice.
If you can believe that.
Now, you mentioned 3D printing, and I can just imagine that a lot of advances in technology have made this kind of work a lot easier and really broadened your horizons, your possibilities of what you can do. Of course, we also have all of this great technology that connects us to other people. How do you interact with all of these collectors?
Well, I tell you what, you are absolutely right. This technology, I mean, it's just mind-boggling with the 3D printing that we got going on now. You know, the ability for these people to draw parts and produce parts and, you know, have them, you know, printed. And, I mean, the technology with the CNC where people can actually buy them and actually have one in your own home anymore and water jets and the parts. I mean, it's just phenomenal what you can do now and then have repeatability and consistency. I mean, it's insane. And then with the world, with, like you said, the World Wide Web that's out there right now, I mean, man, you can have conversation with guys that are in the complete other side of the world, and then you got all these people with common interests, and you pull them all together on some of these sites that are available. Even, I mean, Facebook's real common, you know. You get all these people with common interests together and common knowledge helping one another out. Before you know it, you put a lot of talent together. It's amazing what you guys can come up with.
Yeah. So how much time do you spend in working and collecting and talking about these farm toys every week, do you think, Chuck?
I got a full-time job, and then I work about 30 hours a week with toys. So it keeps me busy.
Well, and Amanda, listening to Chuck talking about all the things that can be done with these models after they're made, that must create a real challenge for you at the Farm Toy Museum. Do you try to get every iteration of something?
Oh, well, we obviously there's no possibility of getting everything, but we certainly try. We've actually worked with Chuck and his friends and have a display of these makers that do the modifications. We have some dirty tractors just to kind of show examples of what that looks like and what the work that it does. He had mentioned putting a pop can. There's one toy that has like a little chain that's curled up on, you know, right, like it would be on a working farm. So, I mean, the detail and the level of customization that it takes to do something like that is amazing, and we love it. We just love to tell that story because that's just one iteration of how, you know, you collect the actual toy out of the box. But this opens up a whole new world of options for that. And he mentioned the 3D printing. We have dioramas that I point out. You know, they're showing old toys or old kind of old scenes, but yet using this current day technology. So it's a lot of fun with that juxtaposition. So.
Well, and thinking about farm toys, I think a lot of us associate a lot of nostalgia with it. And obviously people are collecting pieces from the past. But I'm struck by just how alive and thriving this world is today. Amanda, I mean, it feels like things are growing in the farm toy industry.
Absolutely, yes. And I, you know, the 64th the scale model, the small scale model toys, those are continually surprising me in how they're growing and customization. Younger collectors are really interested in that scale. So it's just been amazing to see the constant growth and innovation within the hobby. And, you know, that to me is what's most rewarding, is to continually be a part of that innovation and showcase that within our museum.
Amanda Schwartz, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Amanda Schwartz is manager of the National Farm Toy Museum in Dyersville. And Chuck Steffen, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Chuck Steffen is a farm toy collector. He's also a custom parts maker for farm toys. He lives in Sherrill, Iowa. Coming up in just a moment, a very different kind of collectible, rare and old books. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We've been talking about farm toys and collectibles this hour. Now we're going to talk about a very different kind of collectible, books, rare and old books in particular. And the world of collecting these books is complicated. The age of a book can be misleading when you're trying to figure out its value. And that's the challenge that led Amy Chen, a special collections instruction librarian at the University of Iowa, to create a game to help students understand this world. The game is called Codex Conquest, and Amy is with me now. Hello, Amy.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here, and give me an idea of just how big this challenge is that led you to create the game. I mean, it sounds fairly confusing.
Well, I'll say that we do have about 200 classes per academic year coming into the University of Iowa Special Collections Department. And one of the things I got asked the most about was, how much are these books worth, and how do we think about their value over time? So I thought a game would be a really nice way to communicate that in a maybe more accessible format.
All right. And so in just answering that question, what made it hard to answer the question if somebody says, oh, how much is that book worth?
Well, rare books are valued based on their provenance, which is a term which means their unique history. So every book is an individual item. And who has owned it before you? What was the printing history of that book? If there's any marginalia, all of those things contribute to their value. So one book is not necessarily equal to another, even if it's the exact same printing, like a first edition.
Okay, so you can look at a book and you can say, oh, this book is 200 years old. That sounds pretty old, so that must be a valuable book, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything.
That's very true, yes. And sometimes some of the oldest books are not even the most valuable. It also depends on their collectability. Are there a lot of private individuals who are really interested in owning this book? That'll make the market a little bit more expensive, things like that.
Well, and I'm struck by talking about the how the book looks, the marginalia, if somebody has written in the margins or done something to the book. You know, when I go online and I want to buy a used book, of course, I'm looking for the thing that is in the best shape.
Yes.
So actually, the wear and tear on a book can make it more valuable?
Yes, because if you're thinking about research value, you want to see what that individual brought to the individual copy. So I might be more interested in a first edition that has a famous writer's marginalia on it than I am a pristine copy, because there's just more to learn from that book.
And a book can be more valuable just because it sat in the library of someone significant,
yeah.
even if it doesn't bear the traces of that.
Yeah, sometimes it does, because it's really interesting to understand like what books were contributing to that person's intellectual profile. So if you know Hemingway read Faulkner or something like that, you know, it tells you something about that writer.
All right. So tell me about the moment when you thought, I should make a game out of this. How did that come about?
So I had only been in my job for about 6 months. I've been at the University of Iowa for 2 years now. And it was around the holiday break. And I was talking to my supervisor, the head of special collections, Greg Prickman. And he said, you know, I've always wanted to have a game that would teach how books are made. And I thought that was a fabulous idea. But my background is more book history than how you put books together. And so I'm a nerd. I went home. And I made the game, and I prototyped it, and I've been working on it ever since.
Well, are you a gamer? Is this something else in your life?
Actually, I'm not, which really surprises people, but I love games because they teach students by having fun. And one of the things I read that is really profound is that playing is how everyone learns, and it's not even restricted to humans. It's how animals learn. So it's the best way to communicate ideas deeply.
And how did you come up with the name Codex Conquest?
So it was a suggestion by one of my playtesters. So I playtested my game, which playtesting means, you know, having people play the game and provide feedback. You know, you might be changing it over time. And I had a group of librarians, and some of them thought that would be a great idea before it had a really generic name, just the game of book history, which is a bit less exciting.
And define codex for those of us who aren't into book collecting.
So that's just the form of a book. The idea is that a book may look different depending on what time period you're in. So it just means that it's a book. It's really that simple.
All right. So an ancient manuscript in book form. That the book form is what the codex tells us.
Yes, exactly.
All right. Tell us how to play. What's the game like?
Okay. So what you're doing is you're playing as one of five countries. You can be Germany, Italy, Spain, France, or England, and you're competing to create or collect the most valuable books of Western civilization. So this is a European book history game. And what you do is you try to create as many collections as possible of either genre, century, or country. So genre meaning something like lyric poetry or cartography, century, like maybe 15th century books, or country, say Germany.
All right. And so each player gets assigned a country?
Yeah, or they choose it. It's fine.
All right. And once they start trying to create this collection, how do they do it?
So what you do is you turn over history cards, and history provides your economy, right? So if your country's doing well, maybe you get a few more credits. If you're not doing so well, then you don't get quite as much money. And you take your money and you go to the book market. And you buy books from either your century or any previous centuries. And you can only buy two books at one time. So you're trying to figure out what's the best way to go about collecting. And there's also chance cards, which are things that happen to libraries, like natural disasters, grants, patrons, things like that. And they affect how you are able to collect.
And the books represent, you said, the 15th century?
15th through 19th century. And all the books are rated from 1 to 6 credits. But those credits correlate to real world values. So if you want to go to the website, you can find it just at Codex Conquest and just search on Google or maybe add Iowa. And there's a spreadsheet there that gives you the actual value of all those books and the sources I found.
All right. Now, just my initial instinct, even you, though you've already told me that it's wrong, would be to, oh, I want a 15th century book. Those are really rare. That was hard to make a book in the 15th century.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the first 50 years of the printing era, they're called the incunables, which is Latin for like baby or baby's clothes. So it it's a special time in printing, and most of those books are worth quite a lot. But, you know, not every single book is quite as valuable. You can have something that's amazing from the 17th century and that could actually be worth more. It just depends on how collectible and how researchable these items are.
And how much information are the players given about each book to try to make their decision?
So they're given the title, both in the original language, if it's not English, and then in English. They're given the year of printing, the genre, and then how much it's worth. So again, the 1 to 6 credits.
All right. And then they can get 2 books at a time. How do you win this game?
So you compete to create as many collections as possible. And your collections are worth more or less depending on what type of collection it is. And that's part of the learning objectives. I really want students to think about genre. So genre, you get to multiply your collection by 3. The century or country is you multiply by 2. And books not in a collection or spare credits are worth their face value. And the idea behind that, too, is that libraries don't just collect books piecemeal. We want to put it together in collections that mean something for users. So that's why collections are more important than an individual item.
All right. So the book's value actually can increase based on what else you're collecting.
Exactly.
How long does this game take?
It takes about 40 to 50 minutes, but when I play with librarians who get really into it or like spend a lot of time looking at cards, sometimes it can take up to 1.5 hours. But my goal is to have it fit in a usual class period.
All right. And what do you want the students to take away from this? I'm sure it's a really fun way to learn, but what is the takeaway when they get done?
The takeaway is that there's books throughout time that are worth different values, and the values may not be what you expect. And then I also want them to think about the genres that exist over time and how they vary according to century. And then I also want them to think about these are some of the most important titles, and to get used to the titles in both English and the original language and know that this is valuable. And if you walk away from the game just recognizing a few more titles than you did before, that's fine.
And do they have to study to be able to play the game?
No. That's the whole point.
But I
want to
make
sure it's fun.
I would imagine that I would sit down and I would pick up these titles and I would never have heard of any of these books.
And that's totally fine. I hadn't even heard of all of the books when I was doing the research. So I like to invent games that, you know, you can come to it fresh and that's completely fine. And also the idea with a game is a good game bears fruit after you play it multiple times. So you get more comfortable and more familiar with the books the more you play.
So do you play like at the beginning of the semester and then again at the end?
Yeah, you could do something like that. I've had students play it once per class period. So, but you can do it a whole lot of different ways. You can have them look up books and do research projects based on what they wind up collecting. So there's a lot of different ways to learn the content, but I want to make sure that it's accessible to everyone. In fact, I really enjoy when high schoolers play.
Now, give me an example of some of the books, some of the titles that we would encounter in the game, because you have made this pretty tricky.
I would say, so we have the Encyclopédie, which is was issued in France around the time of the French Revolution. And I think it's really exciting because that book is in the game. It was actually a multi-volume series, as everyone who has encyclopedias around in print form still, which may not be that many of us, knows. And it's exciting to talk about that and then to pull up Wikipedia and to think about how the Enlightenment brought this idea of a comprehensive set of knowledge. So that's something in there, the Gutenberg Bible, a wide range.
Now, in trying to understand this game, I went online and found that you're just sharing this game with anybody who might want to use it. So what's the idea here?
So the idea is that Codex Conquest is an open educational resource, or OER, and open educational resources are free. Anyone can use them. So if you're a teacher out in Iowa, you know, please look at the website. And if you want to, download it. It's absolutely free. You can email me and I'll help you think about how you can use it in your class. And I can help you set it up. And the idea is that education should be circulating to everyone. And I want to make sure that I'm not creating a commodity. I'm creating something that will facilitate the learning of everyone. And the other idea with open educational resources is that they can be remixed. So you can use my generic game, but you can also build it out to suit your subject interests. And again, I'm totally available to help you with that.
How long has this been available to other educators?
It's been available for a little bit less than a year.
And what are you hearing from other people? Is the word getting out?
It is. I just flew back from a conference in Vancouver, and that went, or in Victoria, sorry. And that went really well. So I got a lot of interest. I've sent it to a boarding school in South Carolina. It's going to Venezuela. I gave a talk at Columbia University in New York. So I think it's really gaining traction. And I think people realize that open educational resources can be powerful. So I hope this starts more people thinking about how game development can be used in their classrooms, and that sharing is always better than trying to keep it proprietary.
Are you getting feedback from the people who are using it?
I am. So we're still in the early days, but so far it's been positive. They have ideas on how to improve maybe the curricula, and that's great. I'm totally down for that. And if people have suggestions, please let me know. You develop a thick skin when you become a gamer or a game developer. And yeah, and then I had a collaborator named Michelle Chesner, who's the Librarian for Jewish Studies up at Columbia, and she built her own version of the game, which teaches Jewish history, and that really got people excited.
Now, I can imagine as an educator, this would be something possibly I'd want to use in my classroom, although I don't know that necessarily I would want to print out and make my own cards.
Yes.
Are you considering creating a version that people can just purchase and you know, get started with without doing the work themselves?
That's a very good point, because right now it is a little bit more difficult to make it. My suggestion is to bring it to a print shop, and then it does cost something, but it's not very much. I want to make sure that Iowa doesn't wind up becoming a distributor, because we're not necessarily set up to do that. But right now what I'm doing is loaning card games. So what you can do is you can email me, let me know when you'd like it, and I can arrange for one place to send it to another. So, for example, one of my games went from Hawaii, where it was getting reviewed, and then was sent to South Carolina. So we can pass it around a network. But aside from that, we'll see. I haven't gotten there yet, but again, I want to make it as accessible as possible.
Now, was there a moment after you created the game and started using it with students, so in the testing process yourself, is there a moment you can point to when you thought, yes, this is doing what I want it to do?
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I would say I did when I was testing it. I taught an honors first year seminar last fall at the University of Iowa, and my students were playing it, and of course they had lots of feedback. But I had one student say that she realized that the game taught her about white privilege, which I found was really important, because that is outside of the specific learning objectives I set for a book history game. But she realized it was very hard as a country that started off weaker to ever catch up to the countries that started off with stronger economies, because it is balanced based on historical reality. And so she was able to see that when you start off from behind, it's really hard to ever catch up, and that not everyone starts with an equal playing field. And for me, that was a really profound moment that I never expected to happen. And I was really happy to see students engaging on a theoretical and a social and political level, not just about books, because at the end of the day, that's what it is about.
Does this give you ideas for other games?
Yes. Thank you for asking. My second game is called Mark, and it's a game designed to teach printers marks, which are the little insignias or symbols that printers used on early modern books, so the 15th and 16th century mostly, to distinguish their work. And scholars are really interested in these printers marks, but it's hard to keep them all in your head. They're really highly visual and complicated looking, and so I'm inventing a game to help teach that.
Have you thought about taking these games online?
They are online, so since you can...
As a video game,
oh,
is what I
yeah.
mean.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, that would be great. I don't have that expertise, but that's one of those things about open educational resources that can be cool. I can always work with others that know things that I don't, so maybe that'll be something in the future, but my skills are limited. So that's the room for someone else.
All right, Amy Chen, thank you so much.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Amy Chen is a Special Collections Instruction Librarian at the University of Iowa. She has created a game called Codex Conquest that teaches students and others about the world of rare and old books, the value of books, and book collecting. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. The show is produced by Ben Stanton, Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. We had production assistance today from Chelsea Hoy. You can get in touch with us anytime. We'd love to hear from you. You can email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. I'm on Twitter as well, at Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.